Great to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You know, I think you might say thanks to Hollywood and movies and a host of TV shows that feature them. Psychopaths are part of our cultural vocabulary. And a lot of people wonder what the heck goes on in the brain of a psychopath. And can we do anything to correct? Is the wiring faulty? It would seem so, at least on the surface. And if that's the case, is there anything we can do about it? And we'll talk about that today with our two guests who've done some really cool and very interesting research. Mike Keening is an assistant professor of psychiatry at UW-Madison with us today. Mike Koenig, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you.
And also Joseph Newman is professor of psychology at the UW-Madison. And Joe, thank you so much for it's great to have you here, and I'm really interested in the research and the work that you've been doing. And certainly I would invite our listeners to call in too. You may be fascinated by how the human brain works. Have you encountered someone who seemed to completely lack empathy or guilt? How'd you deal with them? Those are some questions you might think about. And call us in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show as well. And I have a little cold, so sorry my voice is sounding a little bit scratchy today. Let's start with a definition here. What's the definition of a psychopath? Who wants to tackle that one? Mike, you want to try it?
I think that's right up Joe's alley.
Okay. All right, Joe.
It's a personality disorder, and people with psychopathy are really famous for their emotion deficits, the lack of guilt or remorse, and this lack of perspective that they have on their own behavior. They're very poorly regulated. So when they're moving around their environment and they see some opportunity or something that attracts their attention, they're very likely to act on it without thinking. And the kind of emotion reactions that would influence the rest of us to maybe think twice before we take these strong risks or do something that might hurt another person or compromise our future, those emotions are going to be muted and less influential in the psychopathic individual. They'll be more likely to act on those whims or urges.
Yeah, and that's probably why they wind up in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And why
frequently do.
What are there any statistics as to how many people in the U.S. would be diagnosed as psychopaths?
Well, the common estimate is 1% of the population, and but it's a bit of a guesstimate. Mike and I are using a very rigorous definition of psychopathy that's based on the psychopathy checklist that Bob Hare developed, and it's a really reliable and powerful measure for use in prisons. And about 20% of prisoners will meet the criteria for psychopathy on that measure, so it's a lot higher than in the general population. But people haven't done a population survey using a measure like that because it's really not completely suitable for testing people outside of the prison. So 1% is our best guess.
Yeah. So what's the testing like? I mean, what are they?
So the way we meet with prison inmates, we usually interview them for 60 to 75 minutes. We go through their personal background that includes school history, relationship to parents, work history, sexual history, criminal history, and so forth. And then we also look at the prison files so that we don't have to just take the person's word for it. And after we gather all of that information, we sit down with the Hare Psychopathy Checklist Manual, which has 20 items, and we look at each one carefully. We look at the criteria every time in terms of the information we should use to rate the item. Then we score it as a 0, 1, or 2, depending on how well it matches the prototype of this characteristic of psychopathic behavior. We're all done. We total them up. If a person gets 30 or more out of 40 points, then we consider that person to be a psychopathic individual.
Yeah. So it's a lot more careful than what you might see on CSI or one of the...
It's extremely careful. And the reliability in our study, the one that's just been published, inter-rater reliability, when two people get together, and, well, I shouldn't say get together because they do this independently, but they agreed about a 0.95. Terrific inter-rater reliability.
So that's very high. Is psychopathy, is that what?
Psychopathy.
Psychopathy. Mm-hmm. Psychopathy. Is it something? Are you born a psychopath? Does it develop over time? What, you know?
Well, this is something I don't think there's unequivocal data on. So the research that we've done shows that, at least as an adult, there's an association between the development of this disorder, or the presentation of this disorder, rather, in particular brain abnormalities. Now, whether the brain abnormalities are what's driving the personality characteristics or vice versa, is a matter of further investigation. The best data that that I think we have that bear on that question are the study of individuals who, as a result of a brain injury, acquire in adolescence or adulthood, so something like a stroke or a tumor or an aneurysm, acquire personality changes that are in some ways reminiscent of psychopathy. So may exhibit something like a diminished amount of empathy or guilt, more irresponsible behavior. And so to the extent that the lesion locations or the locations of brain injuries that we identify in those patients are matching what we see in terms of the brain scans of the psychopaths, we can start to make guesses about which areas are in fact critical for the development of the psychopathic personality.
And so somebody who is quote-unquote normal, and not a psychopath, let's put it that way, somebody who's not a psychopath probably is not going to become a psychopath then unless there's some sort of trauma to the head. Likely, it's not something that you're going to be turned into a psychopath by in your environment.
Well, I didn't mean to imply that a brain injury would turn people into psychopaths, or that psychopaths are the way they are as a result of a traumatic brain injury. Certainly there are environmental factors in early age and adolescence that can contribute to the development of this kind of antisocial behavior.
So it's an interesting question, and it's a very important issue for the field that, you know, if you just use as your definition of psychopathy somebody who obtains a very high score on this checklist and who has a lifelong pattern of dysregulated behavior, there probably is heterogeneity in psychopathy. There are probably people for whom the social factors are primary, and there are people for whom a different kind of emotion deficit may contribute to that psychopathic behavior. Both of those types would be different than, I think, the type, this primary psychopath that Mike and I are focused on, where you have this emotion deficit because of some sort of computational process that doesn't seem to be happening in the brain. But I would say that those are differentiable. And, you know, I think when you said, you know, as you think about a normal person walking around and wondering about these others, I think the primary psychopath really is special, because even someone who behaves chronically antisocial way because of their environment, when they come face to face with hurting somebody really badly, they often are going to be influenced by that, by those cues that are so powerful as human stimuli. But people with psychopathy seem to be very specially insensitive to them.
Yeah, they don't seem to notice. Email here, do psychopaths tend to commit certain crimes more than others? Are murderers psychopaths?
So I think the hallmark of psychopathy is what we call criminal versatility. It's not which crimes they do, it's the range of crimes they do. That's what really distinguishes them. So in the prison, you might find people who have committed a lot of thefts or burglaries or assaults or have a lot of drug crimes. They're more specialists and fit into a niche that's more that you can understand. People with psychopathy, I think, again, because the problem is not being driven to do one thing in particular typically, but because they have this problem with attending to information that would cause the rest of us to inhibit inappropriate behavior that's going to get us in trouble, because that's really the central problem for them, they commit a very wide range of different things depending on what day or where they happen to be that day.
We had an email from Joan in Hubertus, another email. Can psychopaths function successfully in life and not become a criminal? Can they, for example, have a genuine partner or relationship or be a parent, a successful parent? I expect she's asking.
Yeah, I would say there's maybe a couple of different questions in there that have different answers. On the first point, there's recently been a book called Snakes in Suits, co-authored by Bob Hare, who as Joe was mentioning is recognized as an expert in the diagnosis of this condition. And the speculation in that book, which is, I guess, not entirely speculation, but supported by some personality questionnaires given to corporate positions of corporate leadership, is in fact that some of these traits can be adaptive in certain environments. So what they conclude in the book is that the rate of psychopathy among in corporate boardrooms, for example, is, I think, four times the normal estimate of 1% in the general population. And you might expect there are other professions where some of those traits could be adaptive, so maybe in some kind of military work or police work, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. So Paul Babiak is the other author of that book, and yeah. I think, again, just to sort of try to integrate the information across domains, it depends on how you think about psychopathy. If you want to see, really, if your definition is really violent or cruel behavior, well, these people in the boardroom are not doing that. But if your definition is a tendency to, that the problem in psychopathy is they have a tendency to focus on their immediate goals and overlook long-range consequences and things like that, then all of a sudden you can imagine this construct of psychopathy, which can be found out, is moderated by level of education, by level of intelligence. And when you have a smart, well-educated, well-bred person who has these same attributes, and we think that that's possible, it'll be manifested as just the kind of poor judgment that people are often talking about in the financial world during the last few years.
Mm. Carol in Oshkosh, let's turn to you. Hi, Carol. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My question is... early child development, nurturing versus isolation, and its relationship to disassociative behaviors. Studies of children that have come out of orphanages in Europe during the last couple of wars, and some of the developmental problems that they have. How is that related to psychopathy?
Hmm. That is a very interesting question, and one we probably don't have time to take up right at the moment, but just a quick comment, and then we'll go into more detail after our break.
I feel like I'm not an expert in that area, and I don't know all of the research. I know there's some good work going on children like that, but from what I've seen of it, they tend to have emotional impairments that either cause them to be very flat or hyper-reactive, and that does interfere with regulation, and what's needed is probably positive socializing experiences. Although there's overlap in terms of having emotion deficits, I think it's a very different issue than what we see in psychopathy.
And we'll talk some more with our two guests after we take a look at the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking today about psychopaths, topic I've never discussed, I don't think, on the program directly. And the reason I'm talking about it is because I found the research of a couple of guys here at UW-Madison to be extremely interesting. Joseph Newman, professor of psychology at UW-Madison, one of our guests. Mike Koenig, assistant professor of psychiatry at UW-Madison, the other guest. And they've done some really interesting research that on the brains of both psychopathic and non-psychopathic prisoners incarcerated at a prison here in Wisconsin, Fox Lake. So talking with them about their findings and about psychopaths, and looking forward to hearing what you have to say in your questions and comments as we move along. And you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and certainly you can post a question there. And we have Margie in Franklin has been waiting quite a while. So let's go to Margie or Margie. Is it Margie or Margie?
It's Margie.
Margie, thank you. Thank you very much for calling.
Well, thank you for the program. It's interesting. I am really curious how does psychopath relate to something like sociopath versus narcissistic behavior? And is it just a matter of degree before one sort of lapses into another? Are they very different, and do you see things like that on the brain scans?
Oh, that's interesting. Joe, you want to?
Yeah, those terms are commonly used interchangeably, and those of us that work in the field are kind of, it's a problem for us because we think those are important distinctions. Antisocial personality disorder could refer to any chronic antisocial behavior, and people may be doing that for so many different reasons. So it's a very heterogeneous group, and it's hard to study them and find some sort of unitary causal mechanisms or processes. Sociopathy is now more often used to talk about some sort of disturbance in the socialization process. So psychologically and perhaps biologically, the person who gets labeled sociopath is normal. That is, they're able to learn from experience, they're able to regulate their behavior appropriately, but they've been exposed to very poor models of socialization. Either their parents haven't taken responsibility for doing that, or their social environment, their neighborhoods, or their members of gangs. And so the reinforcements in their environment are for behaving antisocially, and that's how most of us are influenced to behave. And so being normal, they respond to their environments and behave in this antisocial way, but there's no defect there. Psychopathy is really specifically used to identify some sort of biological defect that interferes with self-regulation and contributes to antisocial behavior for that reason.
So am I still on?
Yes, you are.
So my follow-up question would be, I'm fascinated with your discussion about Wall Street, and I guess on the surface I would tend to think there would be quite a lot of sociopaths there, because I've known people that have been one way in college, and then depending on which way their life goes, they seem to adapt a different philosophy and wonder if they just start running with the pack, then socially they're affected rather than, I guess I've always thought of psychopaths as being more a violent response to things.
Right. I would see that somewhat differently. I think it's a very good point that you raise, and but just like any environment, you have diverse pathways to the problem behavior. So in the business world, as I think you're saying, many people may be socialized to put profit first or immediate gain first, and that sort of ends up in a kind of inappropriate, impulsive, high risk taking, heedless way of behaving. And you're saying perhaps the social factors are primary, and I think you might be right about that. Yeah. But also within that environment, there are going to be people who differ in the biological ways that Mike and I are talking about, people who are constitutionally predisposed to be less sensitive to cues that would inhibit behavior, that cross the boundary, that go too far. And then when you take a person who has that predisposition and put them into an environment that encourages it, that's when things get out of control. Now they're going and then what it looks like depends on, perhaps in this case, the socioeconomic environment. In a business world, well, it looks like, you know, really high risk, callous business deals. And on the street where it's being encouraged, well, it may look like violence.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Margie, for calling. Appreciate your call. Why don't we talk about your research? I'd love to have you guys give us the background on your research, what caused you to think this way and what you did. And we'll start. Mike, do you want to start?
Sure. So, how this program research developed was really through conversations Joe and I started having when I started working here about 3 years ago, about just more general discussions about what are the critical brain areas underlying regulation of social and emotional behavior. So my background in this is through the study, as I mentioned earlier, of neurological patients with relatively focal brain injuries that, as a result of their injury, develop changes in personality and social behavior. And so I was aware of psychopathy, but I was not as deeply involved in the research as Joe has been for 3 decades or so now. And so I really felt there was a lot I could learn from Joe about this disorder and what it means for understanding social behavior and emotion. And the more we got to talking, the more we got to thinking, like, well, you know, if it's the case that that in my previous work I've been, you know, identifying areas of the brain that seem to be critical in moral behavior and the regulation of emotion and different emotional processes, could this area also or be part of the neural substrate for psychopathy? And so we initially did some studies just comparing decision-making characteristics of certain kinds of neurological patients and psychopathic prison inmates. We saw enough of similarity there, and we thought, hey, this is something we really want to take on directly, you know, and the way to do that is to collect brain imaging data from the psychopathic individuals themselves, compare them to a match sample of non-psychopathic prison inmates that are matched for a number of key characteristics, and then just line up their brains and see what's similar and what's different. And so that's how we got to where we are with this.
Yeah, man, you've got some pretty interesting results, as far as I can see, from your paper.
Right, so the results are really focused on a circuit in the brain that for years has been known to play a critical role in the regulation of social and emotional behavior. So it includes an area of your frontal lobe, sort of above and between your eyes or right behind your forehead, and the ventral or lower part of the prefrontal cortex. That area interconnects very densely with a structure buried more deeply in the brain called the amygdala. So the amygdala is sometimes known commonly as the fear center of the brain. So this coordinates the body's responses to threatening situations, thought to play a critical role in anxiety. The communication of these structures is thought to be important. And so this is the circuit because of the deficit in psychopathy that Joe mentioned at the outset of the show, you know, conspicuous lack of empathy and guilt, irresponsible behavior, very shallow affect. This is the circuit we wanted to interrogate with the brain imaging. And we did it two different ways. So one was to look at the structural connection between these areas. So areas of your brain are connected by thin white matter fibers. Mm-hmm. So you're able to do one type of brain imaging that looks at the structural integrity of these white matter fibers. And then another way we can assess the connectivity or how these areas of the brain are working together is by looking at the degree to which the activity in those two structures is correlated. Right. So if they were perfectly correlated or synchronized, as the activity in one goes up, the activity in the other would go up. Right. So you see this sort of synchronous coupling of activity. In the psychopaths, we found that the coupling was far less synchronized.
Mm.
Right? And so we saw this as converging evidence for a general lack of communication between these structures in the psychopathic individuals.
So quite a big difference. What does it mean then? I mean, what is it? There got to be some pretty big implications from this.
Well, I think it gives us a foothold in the brain of, you know, where to help us maybe think about developing new treatment strategies.
Mm-hmm.
So both from a neural aspect, as we learn more about the neurochemistry of these brain areas, there may be an opportunity to develop pharmacological treatment or medicines that can help this condition. Certainly as we understand more about the cognitive functions that these areas of the brain play a role in, it might help us to tailor cognitive behavioral therapies to address the deficits that are specific to psychopaths. So to me, I think the major upshot of this is, you know, giving us some new ideas about how to develop rehabilitation strategies.
Yeah. Some really good questions here, email questions in that I wanted to bring up. Terry was curious about the reactions of the subjects you were working with when they were doing the brain scans and that part of it. And Joe, what'd you?
I've been doing work in the Wisconsin Department of Corrections for 30 years, and we're always amazed at how cooperative the prison inmates are there. They are very happy to participate in the research. They're very motivated to do well, and they find these experiences we make available to them to be interesting, to break up their day, and they like the idea that they're helping. So I'm not sure what the person was asking about, what the anticipation was, but really what we see is a very cooperative subject who tolerates the procedures very well and is pretty happy they participated by the time they're done.
Yeah, and so you've had a really good relationship with the Department of Corrections for many a year.
Yeah, it's pretty unprecedented. I mean, you know, this opportunity to work with Mike is incredible for me, but it all gets set up by the fact that the Department of Corrections has really been open to having research done here in the state of Wisconsin. You know, I've been here for 30 years, but that's one of the reasons that I joined the psychology department at the University of Wisconsin, was because even then, the Wisconsin Department of Corrections was very interested in cutting-edge policy and procedures, and they were open to sort of having research conducted that could improve quality of life for the inmates and also develop correctional practice. That is, how can we better understand the reasons why people break the law, become incarcerated, and what can we do to treat and prevent these problems?
And Judith said maybe they also like to feel like they're the center of a study, you know?
They really like the idea. You know, I can't tell you how many men that I've spoken to say that if this can help some child from having the kind of life that they've had, then this is a very special day for them to be able to participate in research like this.
And Megan in Poinette, here's another interesting question. Have there been studies on the brains of women who are imprisoned for criminal behaviors similar to those of the men being studied?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the antisocial personality disorder is somewhere between 3 and 5 times more common in men than in women, and psychopathy appears to be about 3 times more common. So perhaps understandably, the majority of the work has been done with men historically. But we've done a lot of work in the Wisconsin prison system with female offenders, looking at a lot of the same experimental methods and finding some really interesting things. To answer the question directly, we have in order to do this brain imaging, we actually have to prepare the ground on the prison site in order to drive that mobile scanner in. Mm. Ken Kuehl is our collaborator who has a mobile scanner, and it's a big expense, and we don't have one built at a female prison. But Ken Kuehl, who owns this imaging, this mobile imager, is centered in New Mexico, and he's currently completing studies with female offenders that I think will shed some new light on this question.
Okay, excellent. Ashley and Madison up next. Thank you, Ashley, for calling.
Hi, I'm afraid the connection's not so great, but my question was, so short of carrying an MRI machine around with me, and I think the fact that we're talking now about very successful executives having psychopathy as opposed to just prisoners or other people who are on the margins of society, I'm really interested in the questions of what kinds of assets or behaviors can be signals in the people we run into every day of psychopathy. Is that something they could address?
I think it is. They're both shaking, nodding yes. So
that's a hard question. And, most famous book in the field of psychopathy is called The Mask of Sanity by Hervey Cleckley. And the reason it's called The Mask of Sanity is because people with psychopathy don't show their deficits. They don't seem very anxious or neurotic. They don't show thought disorder like people with psychosis. They have good intelligence. They have good social skills. So all in all, he talks about this perfect human form that presents a perfect mask of sanity. So they are hard to identify. If you were really serious about it or wanted to think about it as a hobby or something along those lines, what I would tell you is that with any personality disorder, it's a chronic process. So you cannot spot it in the moment by talking to a person one time. The best way to spot a personality disorder is to see how a person behaves over time. So if they don't follow through on things that they promise, if they say things and then you later find out that they were apart from the truth, if they take advantage of or take credit for other people's work, it takes a while really to see this pattern of selfish egocentrism, this focus on themselves and this willingness to exploit others around them would probably be the kind of sign that would qualify as the snakes and suits process that Mike talked about.
Yeah, Mike, you're certainly agreeing with that. Anything to add?
Yeah, I agree totally. And I would just add, as someone who got into the psychopathy field, you know, several years ago, for me, the book that Joe mentioned, The Mask of Sanity by Hervey Cleckley, was a total revelation in, my understanding of a condition. And I would recommend, I mean, it's a fairly easy read. It's written in, pretty clear language, and there are some very compelling case examples. So yeah, if you're so inclined, I would recommend check that book out.
Judith, can we put that one up give us the title again, of the book?
Mask of Sanity.
Mask of Sanity. We'll post it on our Facebook page if people want to.
It's available free on the web.
It is?
Yeah,
oh my goodness.
Download the book.
Well, Judith will be spot on that right now. Ashley, does that help out?
Yeah, that does. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. And again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Louisa in Cuba City wonders, it seems like some people with mental illnesses self-medicate with drugs, alcohol to deal with their illness. Is that true of psychopaths?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. People with psychopathy are at high risk to abuse substances, so there is a strong relationship. We published a paper in the early 1990s about that. Although the two are very strongly related, it's not a very people with psychopathy are not as driven to use drugs and alcohol in order to self-medicate, which is what your question was. A lot of people with high anxiety will use drugs and alcohol for that reason. A lot of people with mood swings will use it to try to regulate moods. People with psychopathy don't appear to use it for any reason. It's really something that they just encounter in their environment. And just like everything else, the inhibitory process that would normally stop some of us from doing it in the wrong places or doing it too much are not operating in psychopathy. And furthermore, it's even been written in this Hervey Cleckley Mask of Sanity that Mike and I have just been talking about, that the problem in psychopathy is that when they consume substances or use alcohol, it further weakens their already pathologically weak inhibition, and they can behave very, very inappropriately.
So it just makes it all
it
makes
just
it
makes
worse.
It that much worse.
Makes it all a little more worse. What, you know, we've got a number of questions and callers coming up here. I did, before we go back to the phones, you have a new neuroscience training program here, Mike, that I think is really interesting. And maybe you could talk about the work with grad, because you get your grad students and your students heavily involved in this.
That's right. And I guess it's not fair to them that Joe and I are the ones here to bask in the glamour that is the Larry Mueller Show at WPR. But yeah, it's a great point, and one that bears emphasizing, is that the boots on the ground in this work are the graduate students and research assistants in mine and Joe's lab and Ken Keel's lab. And the success of this project is due entirely to their phenomenal work. So I have students from the Neuroscience Training Program, which is the graduate program at the UW, that, as the name implies, trains the graduate students in neuroscience, where they get their background knowledge of these topics. They learn the methods, how to work with brain imaging equipment, how to analyze the data. The lead author of the study, Julian Motzkin, is currently pursuing a PhD through this program. I should also mention we have other students in the lab sort of speaking to this issue of the public policy issues. We have a neuroscience and public policy program that combines the neuroscience PhD with a master's level training in public policy through the La Follette School. More recently, we've developed a joint or a dual degree program in neuroscience and law. So, you know, we really are going to need experts who are conversant in both neuroscience and the legal issues to, you know, referee essentially, you know, how this data, if and when it should be used.
How these data are going to be used, yeah.
In courtroom.
Christine in Madison, hello to you.
Hi there, how are you?
Great, what's on your mind?
Great, I've really been enjoying listening to this. I do have a question about borderline personality disorder. I'm wondering how common it is for someone who has borderline personality disorder to have psychopathy or sociopathy, and if there is an interface that's easily identifiable, how would you explain gender as it relates to this? Because I've heard that borderline personality disorder is frequently, statistically, more common with females.
Yes, it's a good question. A lot of people, when they talk about psychopathy, will talk about two different components or psychobiological mechanisms. One of them has to do with the affective deficits in particular, and we've been emphasizing those today. The other one has more to do with, like, executive functions and the ability to inhibit behavior, there can be strong overlap between those two processes, but there are also separate biological processes that contribute to them. Many syndromes, I've written about syndromes of disinhibition, and that would include things like borderline personality disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, many kinds of personality processes associated with addictions. And the problems there seem to be that when something in the environment some cues that have motivational significance for the person. So being slighted for a person with borderline personality disorder or rejected, for instance, would be that kind of cue. It elicits a very strong emotion response, and then it's dependent now on these inhibitory processes to get that emotion response under control. And that seems to be the kinds of process that goes wrong in borderline personality disorder. So because that's also part of psychopathy, you do see a significant relationship between borderline personality disorder and psychopathy, particularly as it relates to impulsive and antisocial traits. We recently published a paper, I think this month or the last month, on female offenders with borderline personality disorder. And we did find that the interaction of these two components of psychopathy that I was describing, it's the interaction that seems to be most highly correlated with borderline personality disorder.
Very interesting. And lots of calls that we didn't get to today, and here we are out of time. Joe, Mike, hope we can have you back sometime. I'd love to continue the conversation. It's been great.
We'd love to do it again.
Yeah, great.
Joe Newman, Mike Koenig's our guest today. Joe's a professor of psychology. Mike, assistant professor of psychology at the UW-Madison.
Psychiatry.